On today's episode of Dietitians Only, we're talking about indirect calorimetry. What is it? How does it work? And do we even need it? You're listening to Dietitians Only, a podcast from Dietitians on Demand, created by dietitians for dietitians. Sarah and Lindell, take it away.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to season two of Dietitians Only. In today's episode, we're going to be talking all about indirect calorimetry. Indirect calorimetry is one of those unicorns of the dietetics world. We hear about it all the time in clinical guidelines, research articles, and best practice recommendations, but most dietitians have never seen it and never used it. So today we're going to be talking about what it is, when you should use it, and then finally, whether we even need it. So I'm Sarah Glanz. I'm happy to be here. I'm the corporate dietitian at Dietitians on Demand, and I manage all of our continuing education resources. And today I have with me Lindell Schuster.
Hey, Sarah. I'm glad to be back for season two. And I am Lindell Schuster. I am the director of our account management team here at Dietitians on Demand and also a fellow dietitian.
Great. Glad to have you. So let's get started. Let's start by talking about what indirect calorimetry actually is. So you've probably heard of it, of course. Like I mentioned, you hear about it all the time in clinical guidelines. It's the most often recommended way to estimate exact energy expenditure. It's considered the gold standard when measuring energy expenditure. And it can be used both in the inpatient and outpatient setting. So depending on where you're working or what type of work you're doing as a dietitian, there may be an application for it.
Okay. Well, great. Well, so how exactly does it work?
That's a great question. It's pretty complex, but just in brief terms, it uses specialized equipment called a metabolic cart. So sometimes you'll hear metabolic cart used interchangeably with the term indirect calorimetry. They both mean the same thing. But you do have to have specialized equipment to be able to do this procedure. And so it's really interesting how it works. It actually measures gas exchange. So it measures the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide, which are the two gases that are used during normal metabolic processes. So when you think about, you know, that you can actually estimate somebody's calorie needs and their energy needs just based on how they're breathing, that sounds like some sort of science fiction. It's crazy to think about that. So the machine will calculate something called a respiratory quotient, or an RQ for short. And you've probably heard that terminology before. So if you work in acute care or critical care, that term, the respiratory quotient, that was several years ago, that was thought to be really important when we're feeding our critically ill patients, but less so now. But the machine calculates the respiratory quotient. That's just the ratio of how much carbon dioxide is being produced compared to how much oxygen is being consumed. So the RQ gives us a clue as to which macronutrient is predominantly being used by the patient to create energy.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, this has definitely been a great review. So what are the respiratory quotients for the three macronutrients?
So if you're looking at, of course, in a normal person, a normal situation, we're going to be burning a variety of substrates at any given time. But let's say you were just burning fat, you were just burning protein, or you were just burning carbs. So if you were just burning fat, your respiratory quotient would be around 0.7. If it's just burning protein, it's going to be around 0.8 to 0.9. And then if you're burning carbs, it's around 1.0. So fat's the lowest, then you get up to protein and then carbs. And so again, like I said, most people, if you're measuring your respiratory quotient, like right this second for the two of us, it wouldn't be 1.0 on the dot, it wouldn't be 0.8 on the dot or anything like that. It would be somewhere in the middle because we're burning a little bit of carb, a little bit of fat, hopefully not much protein, but it varies. So with indirect calorimetry, you can have either a resting test or an exercise test. And so those are exactly what they sound like. It just describes the conditions in which you're doing the taking the measurement. that you're doing the procedure. And so with a resting test, your patient or client has to be fasting for several hours before the test. And they also have to abstain from caffeine or any other type of stimulant. So anything that would rev them up, they need to abstain from that for several hours before the test. So typically the resting test, you will have your patient or client lying in a room by themselves. The lights will be turned off. It's almost like you're creating this really restful environment. And essentially what you're gathering is their resting energy expenditure. So think about if you woke up first thing in the morning, before you even get out of bed, if you are measuring your energy expenditure in that moment, that's going to give you the best idea of your resting energy expenditure. So basically, we just try to recreate that type of scenario and those types of circumstances. For an exercise test, just like it sounds like, this test is performed while the patient or client is walking, running, cycling, or doing some other type of physical activity, aerobic physical activity, typically. And so you've probably seen this, like I've been watching the Olympics and they showed a picture of Shaun White jogging on a treadmill with a mask on his face. And I'm like, hey, I know what's going on there. But either way, the patient or client has to wear a mask that completely covers their nose and mouth. And the reason why is because, again, indirect calorimetry works by measuring gas exchange. So we have to completely capture all the gases that the patient is inhaling and exhaling. If there's a leak, or, you know, they have the mask only on their mouths, but there's some air escaping out of their nose or whatever, that's going to give you an inaccurate measurement. And so that's sort of how it works on the outpatient basis. If you're on an inpatient basis, let's say you're working in critical care, if you have a patient on a ventilator, there are specific attachments and little add-ons that you can purchase for the ventilator that will capture all this data for you.
Wow. So can you tell us a little bit about why indirect calorimetry is used?
Like I said, we see it a lot in clinical guidelines as far as, you know, like for critical care, even for patients with chronic kidney disease, lots of different situations, they'll, you know, as far as like, what are the calorie recommendations for this disease state? Well, use indirect calorimetry. But like I said, most dietitians don't have access. So why are we using it at all? Or why should we use it at all? The first reason is really that the predictive energy equations that we have are not always accurate. And so they're pretty good. Don't get me wrong. I'm not bashing any of them, but they're not 100% accurate. They're not nearly as accurate as indirect calorimetry. So that's one reason. Another reason is that sometimes we find ourselves in a really tricky clinical situation, and the predictive equations that we have are even less accurate in these populations. So for example, if you have someone who is on either end of the weight spectrum, so they're either extremely overweight or extremely underweight, your predictive equation is likely not going to be accurate. For example, if you have a patient, a little old lady who's malnourished, she had a BMI of 16, if you ran the Mifflin St. Jor on her, you'd probably come up with something like 1,100 calories. Would you really? You know, it's just not appropriate, obviously, using your clinical judgment, you know, that's not an appropriate number. So also sometimes we have patients who don't respond the way that we think they will to their nutrition regimen. So maybe we're trying to get them to lose weight. We're trying to get them to gain weight. We're trying to get a wound healed. We're trying to whatever we're trying to do. And the patient's just not responding despite our best efforts. They're not responding in the way that we think they should. So in situations like that, it might be appropriate to do an indirect calorimetry measurement because maybe we're, you know, further off than what we thought. Just the same, you know, sometimes we have patients who are having extreme difficulty weaning from a ventilator. So we know patients who are overfed, meaning we're feeding in excess of their calorie needs, that can cause them to produce excessive amounts of carbon dioxide. And then again, they have trouble weaning off the ventilator. So if you have a patient like that, they're not weaning, don't know why ever, you know, all the other stars are aligning. So can't really figure out why they're not progressing. If you're able to run indirect calorimetry, it might be a good idea. And then sometimes you just have these really peculiar clinical situations. The best example that I can think of, it happened way back in my internship. We had a patient in the ICU. She was a pretty young lady, like maybe in her 20s or 30s. She had just given birth to a baby, and a small piece of the placenta was left inside. And so she developed an infection. Then she became septic to the point that she had to come into the hospital in the ICU on a ventilator. So she's a new mom. She's a young woman. She's lactating. She's septic, but she's bedbound. And I remember asking my preceptor, how do I even begin to estimate her calorie needs? I have no idea. So that would have been a perfect scenario for indirect calorimetry, because none of the predictive equations can factor in all those different complexities. So those are kind of your clinical indications. And then of course, there are some situations maybe with elite athletes, collegiate or professional athletes, they may want to pursue indirect calorimetry to get a more tailored nutrition regimen. So those are the main scenarios and main reasons that we would be using it or considering to use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And quite often, you know, those tricky clinical situations pop up. So, you know, that all that being said, then why is it such a unicorn? You know, what are the limitations and why do so few dietitians have access to it?
That's really the million-dollar question, I feel like. And so one of the main reasons is that it is very expensive to purchase the equipment. And so, like I mentioned before, the predictive equations, they're not perfect, but in most scenarios, they can get us where we need to go, meaning they can give us a close enough estimate that the patient is getting or the client is getting what they need nutritionally. So a lot of facilities or a lot of, you know, organizations don't really see the benefit in paying the extra money to get the equipment and the technology. And it also, of course, requires training. So you have to have someone who's capable of using the equipment, can do the test, can interpret the test, maintain the equipment, all that stuff. So it's definitely much more complicated than whipping out your calculator. That's for sure. And so those are just sort of the relative issues, you know, in general, but there are some actual hard and fast contraindications to using it that I did want to mention. They primarily have to do with critical care. So if you have a patient who is on a ventilator and you're going to use the ventilator or that additional equipment to, you know, plug into the vent, and you're going to measure indirect calorimetry that way. If you have a patient whose vent settings are really high, meaning they have an FiO2 greater than 60%, that just means that the air that we're breathing through the ventilator is more than 60% oxygen. That means they have really high oxygen requirements. Or they have a PEEP greater than 12. That is how much pressure is left in the lungs after taking a breath, and it just keeps the lungs open and inflated. So a normal PEEP is 5. If you have a PEEP of 12, that means you have some serious lung damage. And maybe these settings seem like, or this scenario seems really far-fetched to you, but many of our COVID patients who are on ventilators this describes them to a T. You know, they have 100% FiO2, PEEP of 12, PEEP of 14, PEEP of 15. So they're not candidates for indirect calorimetry because we just can't get an accurate measurement. And then also if the patient has an air leak, a known leak, if they have a chest tube and anything that would interfere with us capturing all of the air coming in and out. In addition to that, if you have patients who are agitated for some reason, maybe they just came out of surgery, they just had a painful procedure, they just had anesthesia, maybe they just had dialysis, all of those things, again, can really interfere with the accuracy of the measurement. So you want to give them several hours to calm down and relax and get back to that restful state before we attempt the indirect calorimetry procedure.
Wow, that actually, you know, makes a lot of sense now, you know, why it's so, you know, rarely seen use. Many of those contraindications are, like you said, very, very true of what's going on in that setting. So then that begs the question, do we really need it?
Yeah, so to answer that, I would say it really depends on the circumstances, and it depends a lot on what type of setting you're working in. If you're in an outpatient setting, you probably don't, unless you're working with, you know, elite athletes that really need a tailored nutrition regimen to maximize their performance, then chances are you don't need it in an outpatient setting. In most inpatient settings, like your typical med-surg type of situation, you also probably don't need it. Now, if you're working in critical care, that is where it might get a little dicey. And so there was actually there were two articles recently published in 2021, and they were published and written by Dr. Stephen McClave and Dr. Paul Wischmeyer, who are two big wigs in the world of critical care and nutrition support. And basically what they did, they each wrote an article, one in favor of routine indirect calorimetry and one against it. And so it's really cool to read their two different perspectives. We link these articles in the show notes if you want to go through and read it on your own. But I wanted to kind of hit the highlights of what they said and their arguments, because I feel like they both made really seriously good arguments to their viewpoint. So I'll start with Paul Wischmeyer. He wrote in favor of the routine use of indirect calorimetry. And so his rationale was, first of all, like I mentioned, all the guidelines recommend using it. So really any clinical guideline that you're going to look at is going to recommend indirect calorimetry. And he likened it to prescribing vasopressors without measuring blood pressure. So meaning we're prescribing a nutrition support regimen, but really we have no idea how many calories they need. We can just ballpark it. So would you really want to ballpark a medication dose and just say, I hope we get close? So he also mentioned the inaccuracy of predictive and weight-based equations. So the weight-based equations, that's going to be like your calories per kilogram. And then he also mentioned that there are a lot of new technologies coming onto the market that are easier to use. They're going to be more affordable. They require less training. And so it overcomes some of those traditional barriers to using indirect calorimetry. And so then Dr. McClave, he wrote against the routine use of indirect calorimetry, and he made some really good arguments as well. He cited several studies in which the indirect calorimetry measurement and a 25 calorie per kilogram equation basically yielded the same resting energy expenditure. So he said, if we can get that close with just a simple equation, why do we really need all this fancy equipment? Why do we need to go the extra mile really to get indirect calorimetry? He also mentioned that feeding 100% of target calories won't change or doesn't typically change the ultimate clinical outcome, meaning length of stay, mortality, things like that. And so basically what that means is if we're feeding a patient 90% of their target calories versus 100% of their target calories, that's not going to change the ultimate endpoint there. So he basically just recommended to stick with the traditional indications of indirect calorimetry, like we discussed earlier, when you have a tricky situation or a really complex patient. So he said there's no need to use it on every ICU patient. So we'll let you decide if you have access to it. How do you feel about using it? Are you using it? Do you wish you could use it? So it's a really interesting topic, and maybe in the future it'll be like second nature for us. Who knows?
Yeah, agreed. I mean, it'll be exciting to see all of the newer technologies that are emerging, and kind of see where that will take us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. Thanks for joining me, Lindell. This was a cool episode to discuss.
I loved this episode, Sarah. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And very, you know, very great points on all chords, you know, pros, cons, and throwing in the research. Love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we hope you enjoyed it too. And we hope that you will join us again soon. You can always find us on social media. Let us know what you'd like to hear discussed on the podcast. And until next time, hope you have a great day.
Great. Thanks, Sarah.
The information on this podcast is not intended or implied to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. All content is for general information purposes only. You are encouraged to confirm any information obtained from or through this podcast with other sources and review all information regarding any medical condition or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking medical treatment because of something you heard in this podcast.